Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When I got the news, I was just stunned, shocked, couldn't process it, as prepared as I thought I was to receive it. Because that's the day, essentially, you know, you find out that your wife didn't have to die, that there was, you know, a whole different story behind it.
Welcome to Grief Encounters with me, Sasha Hamrogue.
And I'm Venetia Quick. We're a weekly podcast that looks at an issue that affects us all and yet remains so difficult to talk about.
We'll be chatting to guests from all walks of life on the subject of death and all that comes with it.
Our main aim is to motivate, comfort, and create a modern space for people to share their own experiences.
Could you think of someone that could benefit in listening? Tell them about Grief Encounters, out every single Tuesday.
This week on the podcast, we were incredibly fortunate to meet with Stephen Teep. Stephen's wife, Irene, passed away from cervical cancer in 2017. And we found out all about that journey and what it went through to lose her, and then also him coming to terms with the fact that it could have been prevented probably if the scandal that broke didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, this is sort of an episode on two parts. One is how he's gone from being somebody who was just became a widower at a very, very young age to being an advocate for change and support for everybody that's affected by the scandal. So there's sort of, and he's, as he said himself, he's gone from being somebody who was nobody knew his name, he was just Irene's husband or whatever, but he's gone to being very vocal in this journey for change, and also to make sure that his wife didn't die in vain. But from my point of view, I suppose as well, what was most interesting was the fact that he's two very young kids, and his journey as a widower, as a dad of two young kids, and how that pans out every day when you mightn't be having a good day, but you have to get up in the morning and you still have to do the lunch boxes and go to school. And, you know, he has to go to the supermarket, and one of them might be having a bad day and throw a massive wobbler in the middle of the supermarket, which is what happens most kids anyway. But when kids are dealing with grief on top of everything else, and they're trying to process it, and they find it very hard. You know, it happened to me the other day. You can be in the middle of the street, loads of people swanning around the place when there's a rugby match on, and one of them absolutely loses it, and everybody just stands there looking at you, and you know what's going on with them, and that's all really you need to know. You just block everyone out. But it was interesting speaking to Stephen about, you know, how he deals with those situations, because I suppose there's a personal interest from my perspective.
Of course. And I think when he was talking about his identity changing so much, like just what you're talking about, that he was a husband and a father, and then he was a widower, and then he was the face of a campaign and for change. And so that's a lot to go through in a really short period of time. I think also, as he told us a lot about the journey that Irene went through from when she was diagnosed, and those things are really, really hard to talk about. The hospital visits and the, you know, how what she went through when she had to give up breastfeeding, which is such a big thing for a mother. And she really held on to it and how much she wanted to do it, which I thought was so powerful to hear. I hear him talk about that because I can see from a mom's point of view that you don't want someone to take anything away from you. That bond, you know?
Especially when it isn't your fault. Well, she didn't know that at the time. She, you know, none of the scandal had really happened. It's also, I think, talking about the term widower. I know when I got married, I found, using the term wife. Yeah. I never used yeah. to call Martin my husband, or, you know, the term wife. I was that really weird, that, yeah. you know. But then when you're sort of reasonably young and you become a widow, that's like the shocking, the yeah. you know, you're filling in the widow's pension form and you're going, I'm 44, I shouldn't be doing this. Do you know what I mean?
These it's not. Identity things. Yeah. And they are hard to
it's like
to
a label.
Yeah.
And
it
it's
is.
Even worse than what's happened is this is your new label now.
Yeah.
You're not really a wife anymore.
Yeah.
You're a widow or a widower, or you're not a husband. And it is. It's
and that happens
people.
Overnight. You were a wife. And then the next day you're yeah. not. And you're, yeah. you know, so that's.
Well, I sort of think you always are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, of course. You know. I mean, I think, you know, ultimately, I remember people saying to me, you know, do you feel like you're still a daughter? Well, of course you're still yeah. a daughter, but you don't have that active relationship in your life.
Mm.
I think we both learned a lot from talking to Stephen. Mm. He speaks really eloquently.
And you know, he's so much humor yeah. as well with it. And I think that's brought him this far because yeah. he's sort of, you know, you sort of still. Have a laugh about yeah. ridiculous things, but yet, you know, it doesn't take away from anything. It's
yeah, we both felt that yeah. kind of levity in the room. Mm. He's also incredibly strong.
Yeah.
Like, seriously strong. And I think everybody will hear that when you listen to our chat.
In the past year, this week's guest became a household name across Ireland as the cervical cancer scandal rocked the nation in 2018. Stephen Teep and his two sons, Oscar and Noah, suffered the loss of Irene, Stephen's wife, to the illness in 2017. Stephen, like your story, it's a very familiar one, sadly,
yeah.
For many of our listeners, I think for most people in Ireland, they're, you know, that watch the news or read a newspaper, there's nobody that doesn't know what's been happening. When did you first realise that Irene was unwell?
It was back in, it was September 2015 when Irene got first diagnosed.
Okay.
But it actually began before that. Our youngest boy, Noah, was born in April that year, on the 21st mm-hmm. of April. And we, Irene would have had a normal pregnancy and all of that. And we had a home birth, a planned home birth at that, for Noah. And, you know, everything went perfectly. But it was about 5-6 weeks after Noah was born, Irene was noticing that she hadn't recovered from childbirth. She was still bleeding 5-6 weeks. So went back to the doctor, referred her back to the maternity hospital in Cork. And they just... you know, look, they weren't concerned by anything. You know, you're just after, you know, delivering a child. And they said, look, it could take up to 8-10 weeks
yeah.
for some women to recover, you know. So, there was no concern there. But at 12 weeks, Irene was still bleeding. It hadn't started to die off or anything yeah. like that. So, again, Irene went back again. And, you know, all our thoughts were, look, this obviously has to be childbirth related, yeah. you know. Like, there was nothing at all to say it could have been anything else.
Because otherwise she was feeling... Okay as you feel after having a newborn. Yeah.
Well, this is it, you know. You have a newborn child in the house and you also have a 2-year-old in the house, so we're all absolutely shattered anyway. So you can't really judge
it
like
that
for
it,
exactly. And like for the likes of Irene then, you know, after going through 9 months of pregnancy, do you know what was normal for her at that point as well? So, do you know, nothing was to say. Like she, like when you think about the symptoms of cervical cancer, you know, like backache, pains in your legs. What woman doesn't have that at the late stages of pregnancy as well, you know? So, you know, like nothing was concerning. And then, of course, you know, things like the Irene had participated in the screening program with the smear tests and all of that, and nothing, no indications for anybody to look at, you know? So the bleeding anyway continued beyond the 12 weeks. And at that point, actually, a consultant gave her a physical examination and said, you know, just to see if she could see anything, and had a look at her cervix, didn't notice anything. And actually wanted to prescribe Irene the contraceptive pill because they thought it might be something hormone related. But Irene was breastfeeding Noah and knew that that would affect her supply to Noah, so refused to take that. And said, no, look, there has to be another way. So it continued again for another few weeks. And at 18 weeks, Irene went back to the same consultant because she was still bleeding 18 weeks and hadn't died down at all. And what they had planned to do was bring Irene in for a D&C because they thought there might be some just a birth left behind, you know, and maybe that was creating an infection or something. And it was when they were performing that, the consultant who had viewed Irene at 12 weeks noticed a change in her cervix, and it was only then that they actually took the sample away and got it tested, and that's when we got the diagnosis that Irene had stage B cervical cancer at that point.
Wow.
How did you guys as a family, how did you process that information?
We actually, Irene went in for that on a Thursday, and there was nothing said, and we actually had a trip booked to Copenhagen the following Tuesday for the four of us, and we were going to be heading away, and that was our trip planned. And on Monday, I was up the country at a meeting, and I got this phone call off Irene on the Monday, and she was absolutely hysterical down the phone. And she says, the doctor consultant called and she wants me to come in tomorrow. And I was like, yeah, okay, but we're going away tomorrow. Mm. And Irene said, I said that to her, and the consultant just said, look, Irene, you're smart. I wouldn't be calling you in if it wasn't important. Mm. And Irene just knew straight away it was cervical cancer. It could not be anything else. And when we got that news that day, yeah, it completely floored us. It took a while to process. Mm. But straight away, we're so busy. We had an 18-month-old,
I mean,
and we had
a 2-year-old,
and you're straight back to parents, and at the same time, you're still trying to process that. Mm. And Irene wasn't sick at that point; she was just bleeding heavily a lot. Mm. But like, as far as an illness, there was no symptoms or anything like that. And so it was really, when we went back home, we're trying to process this news, but it was kind of, is this really happening? Mm. You know, like, is this really what we've just been told? It was really hard to process. And, you know, like, it was about 2-3 weeks after that then that Irene's treatment began. And that's when the real reality of it all hit home to us. And probably for the 2 weeks leading up to that, we had to, I suppose, organise the house, essentially.
Mm. Childcare.
And because, like, Irene would have breastfed Oscar, our oldest guy, until he was about 2 years of age. Mm. And Noah hadn't started on solids at that point either, because we weren't going to start that until 6 months old. And we were doing this thing called baby-led feeding, where you just kind of
let them do their own thing,
which is absolutely awesome. But it was, but we were doing that, so we weren't prepared for this, because we weren't due to start that anyway. So we had to kind of figure out what to do with Noah with regard to feeding as well. And we ended up then, the question was, right, do we go down the formula route, which we knew absolutely nothing about, or do we look for donations, for milk donations? And we ended up going down the road of the donations. And Irene was involved a lot with Lelesh, and she'd built up a massive support group. So we ended up getting donations for like the 15, 16 weeks that Irene couldn't feed Noah.
That must be sort of difficult for her as well, because, you know, when you feed your own kids, it's a very personal thing. So in one way, to hand that over to somebody else, that must have been quite a difficult thing for her to
do. You know, like,
it must have been the first stage.
It was where her thoughts went first, and I remember telling my mum about it, and she was like, oh, poor Irene's gonna be heartbroken, she can't feed now for the first time. The bond between a mother and their child when they're feeding, like, it's you cannot notice it. It's an incredible thing to witness. And yeah, there was a bit of that being taken away. And like, Irene was gutted. And like, I'll never forget the first night, because what happened was, Irene was going through radiotherapy for 5 days a week, and she had to do that over 8 weeks. But on the Tuesday, she would have chemotherapy. And as soon as the chemotherapy started, she had to stop feeding Noah, because she would have passed that through to him. So that's when the Monday night after, it would have been the Monday night, I would have started feeding Noah. And I remember the first time we did it was in the middle of the night, because Irene obviously wanted to feed for as long as possible, you know. She literally wanted to bring it up to the last minute. So the last time we did it was on the Monday night. And, you know, in the middle of the night, your child wakes up roaring, hungry, right? And and this is when I had to go down then, and you know, the milk was frozen, so I had to thaw it out. And that takes about 10, 15 minutes, and all at that time, the child's roaring. And Irene wanted to stay away from him, because he'd smell her, and he'd know, and that would just drive him mad. And like, I'll never forget like going back up there, and I was trying to do as much as I could that Irene would, but obviously I physically couldn't do the main part. But you know, like, I had my top off, there was a lot of skin to skin trying to give him those comforts. But at the end of the day, obviously it wasn't his mom, and you know, I'm trying to, you know, he's absolutely roaring, crying. He wouldn't take the bottle for the first few minutes. And Irene was in the bed lying next to us, and she was holding in the crying as well. Heart was absolutely breaking. She was at that point where she was just shaking in the bed, just trying to hold in the tears. And it was just me just stuck in the middle of all this, you know, all this pain that just been brought onto us by this cancer. And everybody didn't want to do anything that we were about to do. But, you know, look, Noah eventually took the bottle, and he eventually got used to being fed through the bottle for those few weeks afterwards. And, you know, Irene had to wait 21 days after her final chemo session in order to feed again. And what Irene did, the most incredible thing, and this is actually the one thing prior to this whole scandal ever breaking that I thought I would be in a podcast or being interviewed about, is what she did during those few weeks. Mm-hmm. But throughout the whole treatment, Irene expressed milk in the middle of the radiotherapy, in the middle of the chemotherapy, in the middle of all the agony that the steroids and all of the other medication bring in. Irene expressed milk 5 times a day and dumped it just to maintain her milk supply. Because she set herself a goal at the beginning of that. Cancer is not going to take over my life. I'm going to control this. And I'm going to feed Noah at the end of it.
And very expressing early on, it is horrible.
Horrible.
Like, as someone, as a mother who's done it in work.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Irene had
That, and to do that under those circumstances seems unimportant. Yeah. How beautiful that it was so important to her, and that she was able to still see what was important to her amidst the chaos.
It was the goal. And like, even going in, the chemotherapy day was a full day, so she would have had to bring all of the equipment in with her. And she, the nurses obviously were fantastic and very supportive, but she had, was hooked up to the IV drip, getting the chemotherapy drug, and at the same time she's expressing, you know, it was you know, she was absolutely incredible. But you know, at the end of it all, then, you know, this fantastic photo of when she picked Noah up there just before Christmas, and like, it was the feed straight after the one. Like, there was no time had passed. It literally just continued, and it was just an incredible achievement.
And that after that, then, how did things progress? How was she?
She was fine, you know. Like, she had lost obviously an awful lot of weight. She was a little bit tired and that from the treatment, but very positive. And we all were, because like, she, I think the thing is, when she went through that treatment, she didn't look sick at all. Like, there was no hair loss or anything else, apart from the tiredness, which we'd only see in the house. But in, like she said, no one treats her like a sick person because she doesn't look sick. So we would have had our first appointment, follow-up appointment, around February time. And this is the one where they scan you and they let you know how everything went with regard to treatment. And as the consultant said at the beginning of it all, look, we're treating for cure here. Like, there was no doubt in his mind, this is what we're doing. And, you know, I suppose that's what you want to hear. You know, that's what you want your consultant, when they say it with such confidence, you know, you're handing your lives over to them. That's exactly the news you want to hear. So when we were so, so nervous getting that scan done on the February and coming back in and waiting to be called to let us know the results. But, you know, the consultant could see how nervous Irene was. Like, we were practically holding each other up, walking down this corridor, and she just turned around and just said, look, I'm very happy with your results. And straight away we just relaxed. And it was, they said they could just see scar tissue, so everything was fine with it. So, you know, that kind of lifted the mood a bit. And
gives you the positivity to keep going.
And absolutely, and after everything that Irene went through, and, you know, like, setting that goal, achieving that goal. So now we were dealing with other issues in our life now, because we obviously wanted to have, we've 2 children and we always wanted to have 4. So now, because of the treatment that Irene had, it would have put her into early menopause, and she was now infertile. So we now had to deal with that, and Irene was a little bit upset with that. There was the physical sexuality side of it as well, which obviously was more upsetting for Irene. Just because, you know, her body had just been, I suppose, come out after this all different, you know. And these were kind of the biggest problems in her life at that point, you know. And then we went to Portugal and went on holidays to kind of celebrate, and came back, and Irene started to get this very faint pain in her back. We thought nothing of it, because she was wearing a sling carrying Noah for all of the holiday, and Irene had a dodgy back anyway. You know, you look at her back funny and nearly giving out, you know. And Yeah, so we just thought, presumed it was something like that. But out throughout the summer, that pain started to get worse, where she would nearly start whimpering in pain. And around August time, I noticed the weight was falling off her. And Irene was always a slim person anyway, but looked like her legs just started to look really, really skinny. And we had a follow-up appointment in September, and they brought Irene back in for that appointment. And she didn't mention anything about the pain in her back. I did, because I knew Irene was just too stubborn. And she's just, you know, she's just a strong person. And it's a terrible thing, you know, to try and admit to something like that. But look, I just mentioned it. And as soon as I said it, the consultant was like, look, Irene, I've been dealing with you now for the last year. I know what a strong person you are. If you whimper in pain, you have to be in a lot of pain. So I'm just going to scan you from head to toe just to give myself reassurance, you know. And that's when they discovered a massive cyst on Irene's liver and tumours in her lung. And they actually rushed her back the afternoon of her scan because they needed to drain the cyst. And they took out a couple of litres of fluid out of her liver. It had gotten, it was that big. And just after a couple of more tests, that's when they discovered that the HPV virus that she would have had with the cervical cancer had spread, I presumably spread before the treatment ever began, and that's where it ended up in her liver and her lung. It was at this stage then, you know, none of the consultants were discussing treating for cure. None of them were actually even discussing that Irene was terminal. They were just saying, we've got three options here now. We're going to go with this chemotherapy drug first, and then if we need to, we've got a backup plan and a backup plan for that. But this time round, it was like, you know, the most severe, the strongest drug they have for it, because this was now a huge fight. And, you know, less than a month, Irene's hair was after falling out. She was bedridden. She was sick a lot. And I think this was the start of that downhill spiral. At that point then, and that was around, that would have began around October, November. So again, it was, she had been feeding Noah again right up to that point, and we were just waiting to be called into the hospital so Irene could start treatment. And there was some delay, I don't know, would they have enough beds or something like that. And we got a call at like 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock on a Tuesday to say, can you come in at 7 o'clock that night? Straight away, Irene, Noah was in the forefront of her mind. She was like, that's it. I'll never, ever, ever breastfeed again for the rest of my life. And that's where her thoughts went again, because she knew she'll never have a newborn baby. She knew she'll never get out of this drug again by the time Noah be old enough. And this was, again, where Irene's initial thoughts went to. Just the mothering instinct kicked in, and her baby again, you know. And that was it. And that's where this I suppose this next stage of Irene's story and her fight with cancer, you know, takes us to. But unfortunately, it was just months of just Irene fighting in and out of hospital, infection after infection. Like within 3-4 months of starting that treatment, she was so weak that she couldn't really put the kids to bed anymore and that sort of thing. And, you know, kind of this is where I kind of started, I suppose, being more hands-on again. I would have always been hands-on as a parent anyway, but, you know, you're kind of, you know, you're
thrown into it.
You're thrown into it, of course. Yeah.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey,
If you're looking for a safe haven to express how you feel, share articles, photos, and memories of your loved ones, join the Grief Encounters Facebook group, a place for support, compassion, and empathy for those grieving.
Stephen, can I ask you about... See, love really changes when you're in these moments. This is where the real love kicks in a way that is probably difficult for most people who've never been there to imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And that priorities and focus starts to change completely. What was the relationship between the two of you like through all of this? I can imagine your love for her is so intensified as you're looking at somebody you care about so much being that sick. But also hard to communicate because there's so much going on.
Yeah, I suppose like for Irene and myself, the communication between the two of us was always fine. Mm. So we were always, we'd always be able to communicate perfectly with her. I think the bond certainly increased between us because it wasn't Irene on her own fighting, nor was it me. It was the two of us together the whole time, every step of the way. None of us ever gave out about... how tired we were, all the work we have to do. We just got on and did it because we knew what we had to achieve here, and that was for Irene to be cancer. I think the first time we experienced this, I suppose, this bond between the two of us, where it's just the two of us fighting, was actually between when both of the boys were born and we had our first miscarriage, and coming home from the hospital that day, and it's just the two of us at home, and there's no one else around, and it's just the two of you in that pain. And you've got the world outside, and will we let people know, won't we, or talking to yourselves? And I mean, that was the first time where we felt that closeness, of just having this big problem out of our control to deal with. But obviously, the cancer was so much more, but the type of people we were. We were like, even with our parenting with the kids, like, we were very transparent. We didn't hide things, when Irene's hair, for example, started to fall out. One day she decided, look, will I just shave it all off? Yeah. And we made a big, thing out of it in the kitchen between our family, as in Irene, me. We gave Oscar the camera. He just went snap happy and recording videos. I just constantly just took the piss out of Irene when I was shaving it. I'm waiting 15 years to do this to your hair.
Do it to normalise the situation, because that's what you think is going to make it easier.
But you have to, because your other option is to talk about the tragedy that is the cancer and the fact that you're losing your hair, and you could just get so locked down in that darkness that you kind of need to be able to do things like that. And I think that's where we were able to bounce off each other to get, to keep going, because you're in this element of fight constantly, and what the consequences are if you lose this fight. So you need to be constantly positive. So throughout Irene's treatment, we never discussed her dying. It was always about fighting and winning, because there's no point in taking it to that dark place when you need to be in this constant mode of fight to keep going forward, but the bond between the two of us, it wasn't just the two of us, but it was the four of us. It was the family, and this is why for me family has always been the main part, there's so many pillars to a family. And even when this scandal broke, I did it obviously to give Irene a name and a voice in this. But at the beginning of the scandal, if you remember, it was all about how this is a woman being neglected in healthcare and all of these things, which primarily, I can't argue, it certainly was with this scandal. But for me, I was at home with two boys. There's no woman in my house, and we've paid the ultimate price. For me, this scandal was all about attacking the family, and it was the family, ours, that was ripped apart in this instance.
When did this all come to light for you, that this scandal had happened and that basically you'd lost your wife because of it?
It was 9 months after Irene passed away. So Irene passed away in July 2017, and Vicky didn't win her case and stand up in front of the courthouse until the 25th of April. So is that 9 months?
Frantically
counting. Everybody. Let's just say
somewhere
it is.
Around that.
It's around the 9 month mark, all right? Yeah. And at that point, in April last year, in 2018, anytime cancer would have been the newspaper or on the radio, I would just turn it off, walk away. As far as I was concerned,
you've done it.
Done it. Yeah. Lost badly. Mm. Don't want to know any more about it. So Vicky came along on a Wednesday, and I just turned it off, didn't care. And she was on the Ray Darcy show that Saturday night, and I didn't watch that either. And it wasn't until Sunday that it really snowballed after that interview that she had on the, with Ray Darcy. Mm. And it was just all of these news alerts on my phone were just coming up about it as news was being drip fed throughout the day. And I reached a point that day in the afternoon that I just said, God, what is this about? I'll read about it. And this is where I read for the first time about Vicky Phelan. She misread smears. She just won this big case, refused to sign a confidentiality agreement because she had seen that there was other women involved in this that no one was planning on telling. And then the news broke that there was 15 other women who weren't disclosed to, who had passed away. And it wasn't until that point in the Sunday afternoon that when that news broke that I started then focusing on this because, right, Irene had cervical cancer. She had participated in the screening program and she was dead. And for me, it was like, right, is Irene one of these women or not? And then, you know, I'm glued to the news at this point. The following day, Monday, I'm listening to the news all day and news breaks that the HSE will be making contact with the next of kin of all of the families of the women who passed away. And it wasn't until the following day, Tuesday afternoon, I was in my office in Tala in a meeting for the whole day and I got this phone call from the HSE and that was when I was first informed that Irene was a part of the women that had been audited, a part of the screening programme.
What was the emotional process? I mean, it's hard to imagine how anyone would feel when they're... I have to imagine anger. I don't know if it was the first place you went.
Shock. I was just totally shocked. It was kind of like, you know, when you kind of brought back to that time when Irene passed away as well, when you knew she was going to die and you try and mentally prepare yourself for it. And then when Irene passed away, you're just floored. For this, it was, you're right, is Irene part of the scandal or not? And I was trying to prepare to myself, look, she's ticking all the boxes here. Irene's life is ticking all the boxes to be a part of this. And when I got the news, I was just stunned, shocked, couldn't process it, as prepared as I thought I was to receive it. And, you know, like, that's the day, you know, essentially, you know, you find out that your wife didn't have to die, that there was, you know, a whole different story behind it. And it was 2 days later that I met the consultant. And that's when you're given the news about that Irene participated in a screening programme, had two smears, both of them came back clear, both of them said, call back for your routine recall in 3 to 5 years. Yeah. And then you're fine, well, actually, they were audited. And it turns out back in 2010, Irene had precancerous cells. In 2013, you could see it advanced even further again. And, you know, you're just absolutely devastated, completely thrown back at the beginning of the process.
When does the anger hit when something like that happens? Because there's so much anger when somebody passes away, yeah, especially a younger person from cancer, that when there's young kids involved anyway. So with something like this, where you know there's somebody to blame, did you get angry straight away?
Yeah, I think I got angry straight away. But I like to really think, I live a lot in my head and I try and just focus myself. What I've learned about this whole thing, I suppose, since Irene passed away, is I have this feeling of being on my own for a lot of it. I don't know any 36-year-old widowers raising a 4 and a 2-year-old while dealing with your own grief, trying to deal with their grief. Like, how do you deal with a 4-year-old's grief and a 2-year-old still in nappies? No one, I don't know anyone who knows. So I've been trying to figure all of this out on my own. So again, when this scandal breaks, how many people in my situation that I just explained are now part of a scandal? No one. So here I am back in my head, fuming like I was, absolutely raging. But for me, this is what motivated me to do something because I could not stay at home with all of this rage and anger and do nothing with it. It wouldn't be healthy for me. It wouldn't be healthy for the two kids, boys. You know, and this is my way. This is my outlet for it. And straight away, I had an agenda in my head of what I wanted to do. I mapped everything out I needed to achieve here. Do you know, first thing first was I needed to raise my profile to a level from absolutely nowhere just so I can start banging down the doors of the people that I wanted to talk to, the Minister of Health, Department of Health, do you know, Dr. Gabriel Scally when he came along. And this is the sort of, I suppose, where my mind went to. But again, like it did when Irene passed away, what really focused me again was the two boys. You know, you have to get up every day for them. You have to focus for them. And, you know, I've said it many times, you know, for me, my mind went about 10 years down the road when I actually have to sit down in front of them and actually have a conversation about cervical cancer. It isn't just the bug that beat mom now, and the doctors tried everything they could. It's now discussing cervical cancer, Irene being brought back into this scandal, and what was the scandal about. But most importantly for me is, what did I do about it when I found out about this? Mm-hmm. And there's no way at all that I could just turn around to the guys and said absolutely nothing. And this is when I basically, like, with my anger and that, just turned it into this rage. And the agenda has always been for me to get the answers of what happened to Irene, to try and find out exactly what went on with this whole scandal, but most importantly fix it and let that be Irene's legacy, that, you know, her life created some sort of something positive, something that was so negative. Mm. If I get to create that legacy for Irene, I get to do it for Emma Fick-Mahuna, the other women who died, but also as well the other women that are alive today living with all of these complications. This is what everybody wants. They want all of these wrongs turned into right, and, you know, everything fixed. But also as well, if there's people to be made accountable, that they are held accountable, I suppose, at the same time as well, you know.
A lot of kids have been left behind in the scandal. I mean, I think I'm at five kids. You have two. There's other kids. How important do you think it will be for them down the line? You were saying about 10 years' time, you're going to have to say to them, you know, this happened, this is what I did. You know, there will be anger there. And between one or two of the kids, it's going to come up somewhere, you know. How do you think you're going to handle that then down the line?
This is why I'm saying, you know, like, creating a legacy. You know, they need to be, like Irene and Emma and everyone needs to be a part of something bigger. Mm-hmm. You know, they can't just be the victims. And this is the key thing for me, that Irene isn't just the victim. Yeah, essentially she is. She was a part of Miss Red Slides. That, you know, they're read correctly, she'd still be alive. But if I just think of Irene as the victim, that's no way for the boys to be picturing their mother. It needs to be something better than that. And like, it's such a negative thing to view someone as a victim. So how do you turn that as a positive? And it's about the changes that are created, that we can go, look, this is what, all the bad stuff that happened to your mum, it's not going to happen again because of your mum, you know. And this is, it's just turning it around like that. And hopefully, in my head, I hope, and again, you know, I'm trying to do something that hasn't been done before, you know, I'm trying to figure all of this out in my head. But if I can talk about what happened to Irene and let the ending of the last chapter of that book be something positive, that no more families have to go through what we went through, then surely that is something that the boys could live with.
Can I ask you about, you know, with healthcare, you often hear about be your own advocate. And I think in Ireland, that's really difficult, because I think even at the GP stage of something, there's kind of, you're fine. It's not that big a deal. Mm. You're all right. And to push, I'm not sure, you know, I feel like I have a back pain and I'm not really sure. To push, it feels uncomfortable, I think, in general, in Ireland, to kind of, there's almost a fear of hypochondria or something, or being too, you know, worried about yourself or whatever. But being your own advocate, that's a tough thing as well, because you might be the person that's not feeling well, or you might not know the medical system enough to push or enough to ask, or in this case, double check.
Yeah.
I mean, what would you say about that? Because people aren't going to question results, but now in the Ireland we live in they should. I don't know.
Well, I absolutely agree they should, but I guess we've just been built in a society where we just put so much trust into, you know, medical professions. And yes, you do have to trust them, but it does need to be, I think, treated more like a partnership, where it needs to work, be work both ways, where both people listen. And, you know, it's when you see failures like this, it kind of raises the question, you know, like, should I push harder to get answers? If I'm not satisfied with that, do I shout a little louder, you know, and try and really get to the answers of it? And I think you're absolutely right that, you know, we should do that. And no one will advocate better for someone than themselves advocating for themselves. But, you know, When someone is sick, it's difficult, you know, and we've been there. And it's, you know, like, and Irene was pushing for a couple of, like, is there any other options and that sort of thing. But I didn't have a clue what I was asking for then at the same time either. So there needs to be, I think, the relationship between the two. Certainly, look, I'm sure it's good in most cases, you know, and like there was great, like I wouldn't fault the consultants with regard to the treatment that Irene had. Definitely not. But yeah, like there's definitely an element of push, like, double checking the slides that time and that sort of thing. But like at the end of the day, you know, the best advocate for someone is themselves, isn't it? To try and get the answers. And I think of just the society that we live with in the past has been one where we don't question our, you know, the people in senior positions. But I think that's changing. Do you know, I think there's a lot of change in Ireland in the last few years. And, you know, I think people's rights have been a massive thing as well that people are trying to.
But people are starting to feel heard, I think. And I think that's, they're seeing how people like you and Vicky are helping change things. Yeah. So they're going, if they're not happy with something, they're going, I can change it too. So you're actually doing such a service to people who would probably 5 years ago have never, even 2 years ago, have never stood up for themselves and go, hold on a second, this isn't right. And it's not just in health, it's you know, across the board. Yeah. You've set up a patient support group, which you found with Vicky Phelan. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, look, I suppose that began that Thursday night when, I suppose the idea of that formed that Thursday night when I came home from the consultants after being told about Irene's audited results. And once Irene's sister and her boyfriend left, they were babysitting that night. I was sitting in the house of my own. And I was like, been given all that information, but thrown and spat back out the door with absolutely no support whatsoever. And here I am sitting in the house again, another night on my own, boys upstairs fast asleep. And now I've just been given this blow that Irene didn't have to die in these misread smears. And as I was thinking more and more, I was kind of thinking about, God, what would happen if Irene was alive in the middle of treatment, in the worst part of her treatment, and she got that news. And she had to go back to hospital the following day or the following week for more treatment. How the hell could she actually walk through the doors of the hospital after the trust has just been ripped from her with her healthcare system? And where would the support be for her? And there was none there at all. There wasn't an ounce of support. And it was 2 days afterwards, Simon Coveney, the Taoiseach, lives in the same town as me. And I managed to get him to my house to talk about Irene's story. But the main thing for me was to start shouting for support for people. And, you know, like, where was the support for me? And, like, I deliberately brought him into my sitting room where it was myself, Oscar and Noah on the couch going, who's helping us here now after I told him the story about Irene? So I couldn't have made it more obvious. And a week later then, the support came in. That was announced by the Minister of Health and Simon Coveney texted me saying, look, we're putting support packages in place. But throughout the weeks, what we were noticing was that nobody knew who the other person was that was involved. There was 221 women that we were told, but no one knew anyone. And the best support you get is by peers in this, you know. So, do you know, like when Irene, you know, when Irene passes away, and you've been talking a lot about grief and that, you know, like I find the easiest people to talk about grief are people who've suffered, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Where a random stranger will try and give you advice, but they don't really know where.
Well, you can't possibly know.
You can't possibly know.
But until you're there.
It was similar with this scandal, in that the people that were involved in it really needed to talk to other people involved in it, because for the similar kind of reasons of around grief, you know. So that's when I contacted Vicky one day and I said, look, we're going to have to set up a support group and see if we can do something about, you know, a long-term support as well, but getting the people together and putting workshops for bereavement and all the different other issues. And yeah, approached the Department of Health. I approached the Marie Keating Foundation first, who got the Irish Cancer Society and the Irish Patients Association on board, and everybody was willing to help. And met with the Department of Health. And to be honest, I was pushing against the opening door. They were happy to help fund it, and we got funding in place for 3 years. And it's been set up now. I suppose we officially launched it September last year. Carrie, who's there now, is kind of heading it up and looking after it all. And do you know, it's going well. We've got a number of workshops. I think we're learning a lot as well. Like, and one of the things is, like, there's 174 women that are post-cancer, but they're going to beat cervical cancer, comes at a very high cost of a lifetime of different sort of illnesses that come and go. And we're kind of noticing, like, for example, lymphedema, there's very little support in Ireland for that, and this is a sort, but a lot of the women would require it, and even outside of cervical cancer as well. And it's kind of these areas now that shine a light on that we're trying to work towards as well, and helping people, I suppose the women primarily in the support group, but looking at the bigger picture as well, how can we roll this out further? So the support group kicked off last year, and it's growing. But initially, while it's for the people that are involved in the scandal, one thing that is clear is that there's a much bigger purpose for the support group, particularly for women with cervical cancer. in general, regardless if you're part of a scandal, because of all of the things that I would have even experienced with Irene with regards to the infertility, like the physical sexuality, even just a couple of the pains in that she would have had. There was very little support after the treatment. And this is something that's been a common thread throughout, which is something very important, that bringing so many people together that's involved in the same or has experienced the same thing. You kind of see this picture. And I think down the line, we're probably going to see something with the support group being more inclusive for everybody with cervical cancer as a whole, because it's just shone a light on all of this for us.
You were started off by saying at the beginning when we were talking about all this, how, you know, you had to build a profile and you had to sort of, you know, suddenly say, hey, I'm here. And so much has happened. This all started in 2017. We're only at the start of 2019. And you've done, like, everything has happened. Your whole life has changed. You've lost your wife, your best friend, your kids have lost their mum. Yeah. You know, you've set this up. You're doing, helping other people. Are you going to come to a point, because you've two small kids, where you're going to go, okay, I've done my bit now, I need to focus on them? Or do you feel you can do both?
Well, right now, everything I do, like, my primary focus on everything is the two boys. Everything I do is built around them and absolutely everything. So me coming up here today or going to a meeting with the support group, you know, the day starts in the morning with breakfast with Oscar and Noah. So, you know, and then that's the important thing for me. A question I get asked a lot, like, is when will this all stop? And when will we get to an end of it? And to be honest with you, I don't know. I'm yet to go home after something, we've achieved something, and sit down on the couch, put the feet up and go, oh, that was a good day. Yeah. Part of this campaign. Every day I go home, my mind, my brain is just tuned in, okay, what's next? And I've been in this, I think a lot of people who have come across me since this whole scandal broke last April think this fight only began last April. But this began in September 2015 when Irene was diagnosed with cervical cancer. I've been fighting every day since then. For 2 years it was with Irene by my side, and then she passed away. It's myself with the two boys. But this seems to be just the only frame of mind I have right now. And when will the end come? I honestly don't know. But as long as I can still be a father to Oscar and Noah, give them 100%. But I want to take them on this with me as well. They have to be able to see this as well, you know, to see exactly what such tragic events that happened to their mother had triggered, and show them, you know, look, you have to get up and do something, you know. When you're faced with two options, do something or do nothing. What are you going to pick? For me, I decided to do something, and it was based on them and to show them. So,
can I ask you, I've been noticing myself, we've been working on this podcast, we've been doing so many different things, we've been doing press, and I only recently, actually last night, we did something on TV, and afterwards I said to myself, where am I at with my own grief process? And it was a weird thing, because I kind of like, it became abstract or something, because we've been working so much on all these different things, and although we touch on our own experiences, we really only touch on them throughout these. And it's, where do you feel, I mean, it's a hard question, and I understand that, but where do you feel you're at in terms of that, the process of grief right now?
Do you know, I've looked at all of it's something I think about, because you hear all of these different stages, and I'm yet to identify with one of them.
I actually thought I was sort of peculiar.
But like, do you find
yeah, we're not into those stages here in this
case. I think we have learned that the one thing we have learned is grief is unique to yourself.
I'm delighted you said that, because anybody else I've spoken to, I'm yet to meet someone who's identified with any of it. And like I said at the beginning, you know, when I was 36, becoming this new title widower, then you've got two young kids, and you know, like where is there out there, what guidebooks out there to base yourselves on? But like, where am I currently? Like, I have accepted it all, definitely. You know, like, the pain never goes away, as you know, and you just live with it. It just becomes more manageable, I think. Like, I remember at the beginning when Irene passed away, it was, the only way I could describe it was just these massive tsunamis of emotion. When you least expect it. And you could be anywhere, like walking down the middle of Patrick Street in Cork, and wallop, and you can't breathe, you can't see, you can't, you know, it's all of this. And, you know, over the months, the tsunamis die down into waves, and the waves come into ripples. And I think where I am at the moment is, you know, I've accepted it all. With regard to Irene, but I kind of sometimes find myself walking down the street, and you kind of start thinking about the whole scandal and everything that's a part of that, and you kind of pinching yourself, is that really happening? Mm. And did that really cause Irene's death? Mm. And, you know, is this now who I've become? Do you know, you could be walking down the street and people would be looking at you saying hi, and you're like, who are they? But they, do you know, they've
because they mean well,
absolutely, 100%, absolutely, 100% mean well, and the support has been magnificent. But it's they recognise me, and when they recognise me, it means they know exactly my worst pain in my life.
Yeah.
And it's accepting all of that now is where I'm at, I think. And I think that's all very. I don't know. Is there anywhere else to go besides accepting it? You know.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think
it's just the levels of acceptance.
It is. Like everyone goes, oh, it's an everyday thing, but it is an everyday thing.
It is.
And every day is different. Mm. And I think as well, when you've kids and you've young kids, and their grief is so extreme in so many different ways. Like they can go from being the happiest person in the world to smashing up your iPhone in the space of like 2 hours.
Yeah.
That it's sort of. I sometimes think you don't have time to actually give that time to yourself.
Yeah.
And I sometimes wonder, because people always say, oh, be kind to yourself or look after. But I actually wonder if that's sort of a good thing, because you don't sort of, you're not constantly thinking,
In your own head,
you're focusing on,
and I think
you know,
for me,
your kids.
When Irene first passed away, how I dealt with it was being very productive.
Mm.
And so I like structure in my life, and I like routine. I like to know where I'm going, and particularly because of those tsunamis of emotion we were discussing, you don't know when that's going to hit, and you don't know what the next thing is around the corner. That for me, it was all about, you know, putting the structures in place around. Oscar was starting school less than a month after Irene died. He was starting primary school, and Noah had never been in creche before, and I kind of had said to myself, I'll take a month, 2 months max off work, but I want to get living this, again.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so I kind of structured myself that in a month. I kind of gave myself, look, we'll get Oscar into school, didn't want to miss the first day, get Noah ready for creche, time it all together, and I'll face the world again, go back to work. So it was kind of that structure that kind of you try and move forward with it, you know. But
it doesn't always go according to plan.
It never does. Yeah. It never does. But like, it's amazing how over time, and you're asking like, where are you with acceptance? You know, like I remember a friend of mine, Kev, going to me, look, I'm not going to drag you out to the pub or drag you out of the house.
Mm.
But listen, my phone is on. Whenever you're ready to leave and do something, just give me a shout. And I remember the first time I went out was the end of September, 2 months after Irene passed away, and just to the pub. And I just went out with just a couple of friends, and I'd never been so scared and nervous in my life.
Mm.
It was like I'm re-entering the world now as this widower. And it really felt that I had this sign over my head, even though I knew no one in the pub, but I felt everybody knew.
Mm.
And it was just absolutely nerve-wracking. And I remember those weeks after Irene passed away, even going down to the shop with the boys. You know, I was like, we're nearly like ninjas sneaking into the shop, grabbing our stuff, getting back out in case, God forbid, someone did the worst thing ever and stopped them or made eye contact. Do you know? Because it was just so.
But that identity change, I mean, that's not something people talk about a lot. So when someone dies, you're no longer a husband, or you're no longer a daughter, you're no longer a parent, or, you know, and like that shift is monumental. And
it
shouldn't be underestimated.
No,
I mean, like,
because
we talked about with Mikey Graham about those levels of identity and like those layers, and they're so important to us.
Yeah.
And when you lose them overnight, you have to adjust.
It was probably one of the most difficult things for me was adjusting to that identity change, because you're re-entering the world, but you're re-entering the world with no guidance. You're doing it on your own, you know, and you're kind of blindfolded in what you're doing, and I really didn't start to manage it properly until I stopped caring what other people thought about me. Do you know? Because every time I was going, I was like, oh, they're looking at me now. I wonder, do they know? Oh, what are they? Oh, look, they have a little bit of pity in their eyes.
It
was all of these sort of things. And then eventually it kind of came to a point after a few months where I was just like, oh, I don't care.
Yeah.
And it's
only, the energy.
It's don't have the energy,
you know,
yeah.
It's just like, oh.
But it wasn't until that point.
The tolerance.
I think it was more the tolerance. Yeah. It just don't care anymore. But it wasn't until I reached that point that I was actually. You kind of accept who you are and you start to move forward. And then with the scandal broke, you have a new identity again.
Mm.
But this time round, it was different because this was on my terms and nobody else's, you know. So you're kind of re-entering the world and you're saying, people, this is what I want you to see me as this time round, not opposed to when Irene passed away and that was being out of my control.
Thank you so much.
Well,
it was wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.